Right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get the show on the road. Our panel today is the Big Heat Police Procedurals. And I spot immediately we have a policeman at the back, so be very careful. We have a late change of our starting lineup. Pauline Rowson, alas, was unable to be with us, but I'm very delighted to welcome Leighton Gage to my right here, who providentially happened to be in Paris and happened to discover this was coming, this festival was on. I just popped over out of interest, and here he is on a panel, so nothing could be better. Now, it's called The Big Heat, which is something of a misnomer. The Big Heat, as any movie buff will know, was a great Fritz Lang film of 1953, and in fact, Detective Dave Bannion, played by Glenn Ford, resigns from the police because it's so corrupt to avenge the death of his wife and child. The real villain is Lee Marvin in one of his early roles. Many years ago, I played for a rugby team consisted almost entirely of policemen. And even then, in the 60s and 70s, they complained bitterly about police procedure and the bane of their life, which was form-filling. And one of them told me a story, which I'm sure our friend at the back knows already, about the young police cadet who went in for his final examination. And the first question was this. It is your first day on duty. As you walk along a pavement, a gas main explodes in the road ahead of you, causing traffic chaos and leaving a huge hole in the road. You find yourself standing beside a car, parked illegally on the double yellow line. Through the open window of the car, you can smell cannabis and alcohol. A young couple are embraced. You recognize the woman as the wife of your chief constable. Over to the left, a man is climbing through a window and descending a drainpipe with a large bag over his shoulder. To the right, a builder mending the roof falls down and lands on the vicar's wife, who is innocently sunbathing on the lawn. And right at the far end of the road, there's a huge uproar as dozens of people rush out of a pub into the car park to watch two hoodies having a fight with baseball bats. Using no more than 12 words, and bearing in mind the provisions of the Mental Health Act, how would you proceed? Well, the answer was given in 10 words, very perfect answer, I would remove my uniform and mingle with the crowd. That man is now Chief Police Commissioner. I'm going to introduce my guests who cover an enormous spectrum. And the only thing which unites their work, I think, is a very strong sense of place, because they all have a particular locale which they describe in great detail and in some cases with great affection. Stephen Booth, at the far end there, is the author of the highly successful series set in Derbyshire and featuring DC Ben Cooper and DS Diane Fry, who enjoy a rather prickly relationship. And what I love about Stephen's books is that there's always one always learns an enormous amount from them, whether it's about psychiatry or handguns or Bulgarian mafia, whatever. He does his research. He seems to have an insight into the Derbyshire police so great that I believe, in fact, he actually works for them and has infiltrated the publishing industry to find out why we have such astronomical advances. He also breeds goats, by the way. Alison Bruce next door is the author of a book about Cambridge. And what's nice about the book, Cambridge Blue, is that she shows it's a real place. It's not just a student hangout. The students are only there for 6 months of the year. It is a large, thriving community in which all sorts of interesting things happen. Her protagonist, DC Gary Goodhue, gets involved in the first one, the Cambridge Blue story, and it's really about the sins of the past coming back to haunt you. Think members of Parliament. Leighton Gage, on my immediate right here, joined us literally at short notice, so I can't say I'm familiar with his work, but what I do have down here, Bill and Toby Gottfried, who are great connoisseurs of crime worldwide and organisers of conferences all over the world. They recently organised the Left Coast Crime in Hawaii, wonderful location. And all I had to say was Leighton Gage, and Bill said he's a great guy and he's a wonderful writer. And I can see from his background, he's lived all over the world. He has so many houses in different parts of the world, he could actually be a member of Parliament for us. He writes books which are set in Brazil. His wife is Brazilian, but he has lived in all kinds of hot spots. He was in Spain under Franco, he was in Chile under Pinochet, and worst of all, he was actually in the States under George W. Bush. And we're going to hear a bit more about his world in a while. And finally, Mike Walters there, whom I think is one of the most original writers I've come across for a long time. He sets his books in Mongolia. And they're full of wonderful characters who are so inscrutable, I would hate to play poker with them, frankly. You have wonderful conversations between these guys. You never quite know what either of them is thinking. I won't try to pronounce their names because Mike will tell us further on. His background is in things like banking and broadcasting and management consultancy. But the Mongolian trilogy that he's written so far are certainly well worth reading. Well, that's our panel. And the first question, obviously, is, let's look at the concept of police procedural. Stephen, I think perhaps you are the one closest to what we associate as the traditional police procedural. What drew you to that particular format?
It's an interesting question, police procedural, because I think it depends what the term means to the individual reader, doesn't it? I don't actually think I write police procedurals in my own terms, because I think a police procedural focuses on the actual details of the procedure, whereas I think my books concentrate more on the characters and on the story. And the procedure, the technical side of what the police do, is almost secondary to me. But you do have to get these things right, because there are plenty of readers out there who will spot your mistakes straight away. I mean, we've got one police officer in the room and probably more in disguise, you know. And lots of police officers do read my books, and they would know if I got those things wrong. So it's very important, I think, to know what you're talking about when you're writing a book like that. And what drew me to writing that was the people, I think, because police officers are very interesting people. They are human beings, first and foremost, of course. And they have their own concerns to the forefront of their minds. And that's what I'm trying to capture, is that human side of the police. I once asked a senior forensic scientist, because I want to know what my characters are thinking at any moment, I asked him, when a detective turns up at a murder scene, what would be the first thing that's going through his mind? I thought it would be something about preserving the evidence or something about the way the body was lying. You know? And he said, oh, the first thing that would be going through his mind would be, I wonder how much overtime I can make on this one. You know, and that's right. You know, I thought that's true, because he's a human being. He's got his own concerns. He wants to know how much money he's earning that week.
Alison, you don't consider your books to be police procedurals?
No, I was a bit shocked. when I first saw reviews that said, you know, police procedural, I thought, oh, I didn't know I'd written one of those. Because my detective is obviously a detective who works for the police, but he'd come out of nowhere. He'd originally been quite an incidental character in another story that I'd written, and I liked him so much that I thought he deserved a whole book or more of his own. But he's somebody who's had a burning ambition to be a policeman and to solve crime since he was a child, and so you spend a lot of time with him and in his head, and the way he actually doesn't leave the crime at work when he goes home. And so I think he's a person who's a crime solver who just happens to be a policeman.
What I like about both Alison's book and Stephen's is they show the police making mistakes and sort of going on beyond that, and they're not sort of, you know, one of the great detectives who always get it right. Mike, you write about Mongolia. Is the police service there corrupt?
It's an interesting question. I mean, what I think led me to want to write about Mongolia, particularly to write about the police in Mongolia, was a sense that it was a society that was coming out of having been a totalitarian society, having been very much under the control of the USSR, very much under the influence of the USSR, and which was then trying to create a democracy. And I think it's done it pretty successfully. It's probably one of the most successful of the sort of former, if you like, sort of satellite states from the USSR, which has recreated itself. And what interested me, I suppose, was how do you go about creating, you know, all the trappings of a democratic society, including the judicial system, the policing system, all those kinds of things, and start to build those things up. And I mean, you mentioned the inscrutability of the characters, and I think one of the issues for me is that none of the characters quite trust any of the other characters, because they're not quite sure what their agendas are, they're not quite sure what the histories are, and so they're always feeling their way slightly in terms of how they respond to some of those issues. So I think the short answer is, yes, there is a lot of corruption, I think, there. The longer answer is, I think there's an awful lot that's been done to try and get rid of that corruption and to deal with it.
Mike's books tend to begin as police procedurals and halfway through change gear and rev up and turn into thrillers, which makes them wonderfully exciting. Leighton, would you describe your books as police procedurals or thrillers?
They are police procedurals to a certain extent. The thing is that what happens in many, I guess, third world countries, and I think Mike is, in writing about Mongolia, is also writing in terms of a third world country, is that there are tremendous differences. Okay, there was a transformation, for example, in law enforcement in the United States with the Miranda decision. Everybody knows, you know, Mirandize him, read him his rights. Okay, and this, from the time that came in, trying to get confessions from criminals became very difficult, because the first thing the cops would say to the guy was, you have the right to remain silent. Oh, cool, I'm going to stay silent. You know, and he'd do that. And this put a tremendous influence on forensics in the United States. It developed, the whole forensic infrastructure today developed because of the Miranda decision. Now, in Brazil, that's not a problem. First of all, because they don't have any Miranda decision to deal with, so they don't read anybody their rights. And second, it's like the old third degree. They apply it. So they depend much more on confessions, which, quite honestly, they'll often beat out of the person that they find a suspect. And this war between the police and the law is very, very unusual in Brazil. More policemen are murdered in the city of Rio de Janeiro each year than in all of the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom combined. It's one city. It's very often the case that a policeman might be robbed, just like anybody else is robbed. And if he's in plain clothes, a good friend of mine went to law school with my brother-in-law. And he was, for a long time, now he's moved over to intelligence, but he was, for a long time, the head of the 700-man-strong murder squad in the city of Sao Paulo. And yeah, he's understaffed with 700 men investigating only homicides. Okay, and he will not travel with his police credentials on his person. He keeps them under the spare tire in his car, because should he be stopped by a criminal and they discover he's a cop, they will kill him. So here's a man who walks around every day of his life carrying three firearms, one in the small of his back, one in a holster on his belt, and one in an ankle holster. But he does not carry his credentials. It's warfare. So it's very different. and therefore, again, you know, speaking to what Stephen said, he said, you have to get it right. Yeah, I was saying earlier this morning to Edward, I get it right because I know what it's all about, and I've spent much of my time in Brazil over the last 30 years. And my family down there is immense. My wife has 62 first cousins. So that's the biggest part of my family, right? And, of course, with 62 first cousins, you meet a lot of people, and there are several cops in the family. My cops are federal cops. I made them federal cops because in Brazil there is no DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration. There's no Secret Service in the American sense of the Secret Service, which is Treasury Department, Protection of the President, counterfeiting, that sort of thing. There are no internal affairs divisions in most police departments. All these, and the roles of internal security, like the FBI in the United States, all of these are the federal police. So they have a national mandate, and they get involved in a lot of things. And police corruption, we talked about that, is enormous. So recently, the federal police in the city of Manaus alone busted 126 policemen for crimes ranging from murder to extortion. So, you know, often the criminals have day jobs. They're cops. Sorry, I'm talking.
It's okay. Let's just talk about your protagonist particularly. Alison, I suspect that your DC moves in a slightly different world from the one we've just heard about. Tell us in detail about Gary Goodhue.
Gary Goodhue, as I said before, he's wanted to be a policeman since he was 11. And I think now he's the youngest DC at Cambridge's Parkside Station, and that gives him the interesting position of gradually finding out whether the job is going to live up to what he was expecting. It's probably for him a bit like, you know, anybody else wanting to be a pilot or a pop star and then actually finding themselves in that position and maybe thinking, well, yeah, it's not quite what I thought it was. However, he does feel very passionate about the job. And he's typically, I suppose, a little bit of a loner, but maybe in a slightly different way to what's become the norm. He hasn't yet, and I don't know if he will, he doesn't yet have a drinking problem, or he's not yet divorced, and he's actually got it quite together. What he does have, he was packed off to boarding school when he was 11, and he didn't really fit in because he'd come from a comprehensive school, and he was suddenly sent to this boarding school where he didn't know anybody and didn't fit in. And he spent a lot of time watching old films, black and white films, old sort of classic movies, and developed this very distinct sense of right and wrong. And he's trying to take that into the workplace.
Mike, I won't attempt to pronounce the names of your protagonists working for the Serious Crime Squad in Mongolia. What puzzled me at the end was, do they actually have a moral code?
Yes, good question. I think there are just sort of two main protagonists. There's a chap called Nergwi, who's was formerly the head of the Serious Crime Team and has now been promoted into a slightly shady job in the sort of Ministry of Security. And I did that deliberately because I wanted to give this kind of bridge into the sort of governmental and the slightly shadier sort of security services side of what was going on. And then Dori Palam, who's his protege, who's now taken on the role of head of the Serious Crime Team, and has probably been promoted a bit too young, I think, is my sense of it. He's sort of coming to grips with the job and struggling with it a little bit, and perhaps is overcompensating in some ways for his lack of experience in the job. And I think I suppose my sense is that both of them do have a very strong moral code. I think Dori Palam particularly has a very strong moral code, and I think he has a sense of what he wants the job to be and how he wants to do the job, but perhaps hasn't yet quite got the skills and experience to do it in the way he'd like, and therefore is kind of struggling a bit with that. I think Nergwi is a bit more of a mysterious character in the sense that he has roots that go right back into the former society, the former regime, and it's not quite clear yet what some of those roots might be and what some of that history might be. He has a very strong sense of kind of national identity and patriotism, if you like, and what Mongolia is about. And I think that's the thing that kind of drives him. But whether his sense of what that is the same as everyone else's, and whether it's the same as Dori Palam's, I think is one of the questions that kind of is bubbling away beneath the books. I think in a sense what both of them are struggling with is coming to grips with what does morality mean in that kind of society, and that's a society that's still very much feeling its way.
Stephen, tell us a bit about you. You have two protagonists, and the tension between them is really a very important element in the books. Tell us a bit more about them, please.
That wasn't something I planned, actually. That developed naturally. Yeah, I have two main characters, two very different people, but both of them young. I mean, like Alison, I didn't want to be writing about middle-aged alcoholics because other people have done it better. And at least they were young at the beginning of the series. I'm writing the 10th book about them now, so they have aged a little bit over that time. But I have DC Ben Cooper, who is the local boy who was born in the Peak District, the area I write about, and grew up. And everybody knows him, and he knows everybody. And crucially, his father was a police officer, so the police is in his family, and was killed on duty. So Ben has an awful lot to live up to, and it's quite a weight of expectations on him. But he is a very principled character, and I think that's one of the reasons a lot of readers really like him, because although he does make mistakes and he goes against procedure sometimes, he does it for his own reasons, for his own moral code. He has his own sense of justice, and I think that appeals to a lot of readers. And the other character is D.S. Diane Fry, who is the complete opposite to Ben. She's the outsider who comes into Derbyshire from the big city, in this case Birmingham, and she has a totally different attitude, and she is much more the hard-edged, aggressive, ambitious character. And let's face it, she is the better police officer at the end of the day, as a lot of women are these days. Policing has changed so much that women often do make better police officers. And she is the one of the two who gets the promotion, so she is now Ben's boss. And obviously that causes part of the tension between the two of them that you referred to, I think.
Yes, way back in the 1960s, I used to write for a series called Z Cars, which was on in 2 half-an-hour episodes, and we had to solve a crime in an hour, basically, which imposed a dreadful discipline on us. In reality, and this is what Stephen's books do so well, the case takes a long time, and there's an enormous amount of repetition, but he writes in such a way, and so does Alison, incidentally, we don't get that awful sense of repetition. We just get a nice, well-paced resolution of the crime. Tell us a bit more about your protagonist, Silvio, and you didn't answer the first question. Are you a police procedural man, or are you
Absolutely.
A thriller writer?
No, it's definitely police procedurals.
Let me ask a question of the audience first. How many of you are not writers, published or unpublished?
Oh, good. Okay, well then,
you know, because that determines a bit the kind of response that I'd give to these questions. I have five protagonists, and each of them has different personalities. All of them are federal cops, except for one. And that isn't a person, that's a country, and that's Brazil. So I am a Brazil nut. Every one of my books, the first three books, for example, deal with issues. To try and give you a parallel, imagine the story that Umberto Eco tells in The Name of the Rose occurring anywhere else other than in a medieval monastery, yep. right? So my stories in those first three books couldn't occur anywhere else except in Brazil, just to give you a small example. The first book deals with liberation theology and land reform. Now, in the land reform, these are essentially land wars between the rich and the landless. People sometimes have the impression that Brazil is a poor country. Brazil is not a poor country. Brazil is a very rich country, very rich. It has, outside of the United States, the largest fleet of private jets, the largest fleet of private helicopters in the world. They put satellites into space. They have a computer industry. They have an automotive industry. They are the world's largest exporter of soy, world's largest exporter of beef. The economy of the country is within the top 10 in the world. Sometimes it's the eighth. It varies. It's larger than the economies of the next six countries in South America combined. And people don't know this, but what happens is that this wealth is in the hands of very few. And because of the polarization of the wealth, this generates certain kinds of crimes. And these are as much a part of the whole pie as the protagonists themselves, which are these federal cops, each of whom has a different motivation. And I won't get into this in detail. But anyway, five protagonists, one of them a country, and essentially, yes, very much police procedurals. The first one is land wars and liberation theology mixed into it. So you wouldn't find federal policemen getting involved in this sort of thing anywhere else.
How do you keep up to date, Stephen, with latest developments in police procedure and in forensics?
Well, I think the short answer is I don't, because I talk to a lot of police officers, obviously, and they will tell you that they can't keep up to date. You know, because there are so many changes in legislation constantly coming in, particularly this government we've had for the last few years has brought in so much new legislation that police officers, you know, have to go to the book to find out what the law is, and so many changes in procedure and in the regulations and the different types of form that they have to fill in that they can't keep up to date. So when I'm writing a book that's going to be published in a year's time, I don't know what the procedure is going to be by then, so you can't hope really to get it totally accurate. And actually, I mean, just to go back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, one of the reasons I don't think of my books as primarily police procedurals is that I couldn't possibly write a book that was totally authentic in terms of the procedure, the way a major investigation is actually carried out. Nobody would want to read it. You know, if I was writing completely true to life, my characters would spend the first 29 chapters sitting in the office filling out the paperwork, and then in chapter 30, a member of the public would phone up and tell them who committed the murder. And that would be true to life, but who would want to read that? So, you know, you have to put that aside and think, I'll use a certain amount of authentic procedure, but you can't let that weigh the story down too much. That's the way I view it anyway.
Alison, you showed your book to a detective before it was published.
Yeah, I have several people that I can call upon to look at, and I sort of feel the important thing is to get key things right, the sort of things that are going to be a make or break, whether people find it believable or not. And but I had a detective a female detective at Parkside Station, who decided to buy the book as a birthday present for her husband, who's senior investigating officer also at Parkside Station, simply because on the front cover it says the first murders committed on Midsummer Common, and they happen to live facing onto Midsummer Common. And he wrote me an email. He tracked me down through, I got three emails simultaneously because he tracked me down through Facebook and MySpace and whatnot. And this email said, my girlfriend, wife, bought this book for my birthday and I thought I was going to hate it. However, I really enjoyed it. And please, you know, let me know if you need any information for your next book. And so I kind of felt that was quite a good test, really, because he's, you know, actively doing the job at the moment, and I hadn't kind of primed him to like it in the first place, so I was quite pleased with that.
Mike, how do you research police procedure in Mongolia?
it's an interesting question. I guess there are two bits to what I do. I mean, the first is I do a lot of research about Mongolia generally, and that's a kind of ongoing process for me. It's just there all the time. I suppose anyone who's seen the blog I do, what I tend to do on there is to kind of throw up little bits of research that I can't fit into the book, which entertain me or interest me in various ways about Mongolia, because it's a sort of extraordinary and fascinating country with all kinds of different things going on that you probably wouldn't expect. So there's that side of it. There's also the kind of police procedural side. Now, I have to say, one of the advantages to me about writing about Mongolia is that you know, I can make things up to an extent that's perhaps easier than, say Stephen Allison, most of you wouldn't know if it was true or not. I mean, having said that, I try not to. What I try to do is to make it as accurate as I can in terms of understanding, you know, the way the organisation works. But particularly, I think the police organisation itself, that's the bit more than anything else I've fictionalised, yep, deliberately, because I wanted to kind of create an environment in which I could explore certain issues or certain things. And so that's the bit that probably is least like, you know, the way things really happen, which is, as Steve said, is probably a lot duller and a lot less exciting than reality. The other side of what I do is that I've got a day job, which is, I think, as Ed mentioned, is a management consultant. Also mentioned I worked in banking, and I think if I'd been an MP, it would have made me completely unpopular with the but what that does do is I work in a kind of quite a specialist field where I do a lot of kind of job profiling and so on. And I've worked in some very interesting organisations in the last year. I've worked a lot in police forces. I worked a lot in the prison service. I've worked in serious organised crime agency, fascinatingly, over the last few years. And I spend a lot of time with people talking about what their jobs are and how their jobs work and what the elements of them are. And so that gives me a lot of insights into those kinds of organisations and how they work. And I think more than anything else, not so much perhaps into the procedural side as into the kind of organisational politics, the organisational tensions and all those kind of things. And that's the bit, I suppose, that really interests me is all those kind of the bits where people are treading warily around each other and the bits where soccer are sort of dealing with police forces and how that works and so on. And in different ways, although I've translated some of that into the Mongolian society, I'm drawing an awful lot on you know, those kind of experiences and that kind of background.
Leighton, when you're not working part-time for the Brazilian Tourist Board, do you have a mole inside the Federal Police?
I began to have some access to the police in Sao Paulo because in a former life I used to make documentaries. And one day I was sitting in Sao Paulo and I picked up the newspaper and read an article about a fellow who was the second policeman ever to be invited to participate in the program of the National Academy run by the FBI. Now, in the United States, you have the FBI National Academy and you have the FBI Academy. The FBI Academy trains agents for the FBI. The FBI National Academy is a course for senior policemen. And normally, these are mostly Americans, but each year, they pick a few people who are considered, excuse me, to be people of great potential who will go up in the hierarchy of different countries, and they invite them to come to the United States and participate in this course at the cost of the American government. The advantage for the Americans is obvious. They have a system of informal relationships which works better than Interpol. You know, so if you have a problem in Brazil, you call that guy that you went through the course with. So this fellow had done the course, and I got in touch with him. And I said, look, I'm interested in making a documentary about your experiences. Well, we shot about 4 or 5 days. And in the end, you know, that's the interesting thing about documentaries. You look at it and you say, I haven't got anything here that's decent at all. So we never did make the film. But I became very curious about this and his life and whatever. And then I started asking around and finding other people and contacts. And then earlier today I talked about that fellow that ran the murder squad in Sao Paulo. And through access with these kind of people, I began to get involved with the Brazilian police. And I started following them around and going to sites. One thing that did strike me is the fact that it's all much simpler and more straightforward than we would normally put in a novel. So in this sense, I agree with Stephen. We tend to complicate it a bit to make it interesting. Right?
Do you want to come back, Stephen?
Yeah, I actually find that I get too much information from Derbyshire Police, Derbyshire Constabulary, as they call it, because I've got to know them very well, and I've discovered that they think what I do is very exciting and glamorous. and they love the fact that I'm writing books about them, you know, and now they bombard me with information which I don't want. I don't want all the technical stuff. For example, about 2 years ago, they got a new helicopter for the air support unit that's based in Derbyshire. And immediately I got a phone call saying, come and have a look at our new helicopter, because it's really cool, you know. And I don't want to know exactly how all the equipment...
But you did want a flight now.
I don't want to know exactly how all the equipment works. That's not the sort of book I'm writing. But I went because I wanted to sit and listen to those people talk about how they do the job and how they think about it. And they're always full of anecdotes, you know. Yeah. And I love that kind of stuff. And just one little detail. Last time I went into Buxton Police Station in Derbyshire, which is the nearest one to my fictional E Division, I went into the CID room, and I sometimes think of Derbyshire as a third world country, because you know, when you walk into those police stations, it's nothing like what you see on TV, I can assure you. And there was nobody in the CID room apart from one young DC who looked about 15 years old. You know. But the thing I noticed was up on a whiteboard inside of the room had been written, it said, Sergeant Smith's Law, lack of resources plus lack of staff equals shit hitting the fan. and I wrote that down straight away. You know, that went into a book.
Am I right in thinking that the Derbyshire Police are not amongst the elite of British police? In fact, a couple of years ago, they were actually refused a certificate of roadworthiness, basically. Is that right?
Sorry, sir.
The Derbyshire Police were refused a certificate of kind of roadworthiness.
Yes, of course, yeah. They were just a totally inefficient police force, yeah. Yeah. Which is great, isn't it?
That's why you write about them. Very often, police procedurals are plot-driven, but in the case of all our writers, it's actually the characters that come out very strongly. When you conceive of the novel, which comes first for you, plot or character? Mike?
In my case, definitely character first. But what I find is that the characters drive the plot. And I usually start off with a sort of loose idea of where the plot's going to go and a sort of framework of that. And then quite quickly into it, I mean, probably two or three chapters in, I find it's kind of gone off in all kinds of different tangents, usually driven by what the characters are doing, what the characters want. And I kind of like that, because I think if it's surprising me, then hopefully it's going to surprise the reader as well. You know, so that's very often the way it goes for me. And I think also I find I'm gradually getting to know the characters. And again, you mentioned inscrutability. And for me, you know, I start off with this sense of who these characters were. And I'm gradually myself finding out things about them as I write more of the books, and that's, you know, as I say, again, if it's interesting me, I'm hoping it's interesting to people out there as well.
Alison, plot or character, which came first?
Character, definitely, because I think people want to read somebody's story, somebody's journey, and so I think finding a character that you really want to stay with as a writer for a whole book, because you spend a long time with that writer compared to the person reading it, you've got to feel that very strongly that person has a story that you want to tell. So always character.
Yeah. Leighton, all the reviews I've read of your books say you have terrific plots. Plot or character for you, or both?
Plot. And the reason for that is I knew from the very beginning that I'd be writing a series. And of course, you know, you don't really have a good book without good characters and good plot. But I knew that I would have the time to develop these characters from book to book. And I didn't want to tell too much in the very beginning. And indeed, these characters grow. So I had a basic idea that one fellow would be an eminence grise, he'd be the most important one. One guy would be sarcastic. Different characters in order to inject humor. Because I also think that in these kind of books, humor is a lot of fun. And it kind of leavens the tone. You know, the whole thing doesn't stay that heavy. And in order to do that, you have to have certain kinds of personalities. But I knew that in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 books, I'd be developing that. So today, what I look for is a cracking good story. It's a plot. That's what I look at first.
Yes, I think the sort of chat between police that Stephen's been talking about is very important. Many, many years ago, I taught drama in a prison. And on the Monday, I would be in with this crowd of criminals. And on Saturday, I would be playing rugby with the guys who put them there. And it was very nice to actually talk. And I would say, oh, PC so-and-so arrested you, didn't you? And you've got crime from both sides, which was wonderful. The kind of interplay between the two is fascinating. Stephen, plot a character for you.
Well, I don't plot my books at all. That's true.
Don't believe that. You should read them. They are terrific. You read Scared for Life. It's a wonderful book.
And I'm always surprised when I read reviews and say another masterfully plotted book. I don't plot my books at all, and this is the honest truth.
Actually, the person who said that was Reginald Hill.
Yes, and that was a great compliment, but he's wrong. I start with the characters, first and foremost. I've got to believe in the characters as real people before I can do anything else. You know, I've got to know who they are, and the place as well is very important to me. And then when I feel confident in them, I'll put them into a situation, which will usually involve a dead body, of course, and I just turn them loose and watch what they do. So as already been said, the story arises out of the characters.
Yeah.
And I have no control over the plot. It just happens. Whatever the character's going to do, they're going to do, and I just follow them. Which might sound a bit strange when I'm writing a crime novel and it all has to come together at the end. I think I'm very lucky in that I'm writing the sort of book I am with two detectives as the central characters because the way I see it is it's their job to find out what happened, not mine. They're the detectives, right? I'm just the writer. And I trust Ben Cooper and Diane Fry totally just to do their job, go out and be the detectives and discover that who did it for me. And so far, fingers crossed, they've done it every time.
That's really advanced delegation.
What you're saying, I think, is that what you're saying is that nobody's found you out so far. That's what our members of Parliament used to say. Now, could we take some questions from the floor? Before I do so, can I remind you that the best question, and that'll be adjudicated by all of us democratically, actually gets a goodie bag, and Peter at the back there is ineligible because he wins every time. Toby, I'm sorry. Toby. Yes, I'm asking you.
A very important aspect of police procedure these days. I haven't heard one word about forensics, so can you please someone tell me about the use of the laboratory forensic scientists in your books?
Anybody want to answer that one? Mike?
They'll answer me in my books, actually. It's not an area that particularly interests me. I mean, it's... I suppose that's, you know, I know there are lots of people out there who are fascinated by these, and there are lots of authors who are producing work in that field. And I suppose, never say never, but at the moment, I find it's very much something, if it exists at all in the book, it's very much in the background. And it's very much something which is perhaps drawn on as something that people might want to use as a tool. But it's not something that's foregrounded at all in anything that I write. As I say, I think really just because I just don't particularly myself find it a sort of fascinating subject. But I think if I'm writing a different kind of book, and if I'm writing a book in a different kind of location, then probably it might well be much more to the fore than it is.
Alison, you?
Yeah, I think that it's important to, personally, when I have a murder, I'd like to show what the first thoughts are about what the body's... what's happened to the body, and so I do have a pathologist in the book who's sort of a cameo role, really. And I'm lucky enough, I've got a friend, he's called Torlin Holstein, and he's a senior Home Office pathologist, and he's actually going to get a little character named after him in an upcoming book, a guy called Holstein with a dog called Torlin, or the other way around. And he allows me to ask him very long, involved questions, and I find it particularly interesting what certain injuries will do to the body, and then when you come and look at those cold, what the immediate assumptions or questions they raise and how that might lead you down the wrong path. So I'd like to have some of that in there, and the book I'm writing at the moment, I have a body in a fire, and Torlin's complaint was that quite often bodies in fires are really misrepresented in fiction. So I've spent quite a lot of time trying to get that correct. And I do enjoy that side of it. I would never take on writing a whole book in that vein, but I think for those chapters, whether it's two or three in the book, it's really important to get them right, and I do work hard to do that.
Leighton, do you have much forensic evidence in your books?
Not very much, Edward. What happens is it's very easy to research that in Brazil because there's one university, which is the University of São Paulo at Campinas, which is the place where most of the forensic criminologists are trained, and they have the best forensics in the country. So if you go over there and talk to some of the professors, you can pretty much stay up to date. The problem is that, again, resources aren't there. The money isn't there. So what happens is that those resources tend to be applied only in high-profile cases. Mm. Otherwise, yeah, it doesn't get used. And therefore, in my books, it isn't really that important. Mm.
Stephen, what about you?
Yes, I think, like Alison, I spend quite a bit of time researching very strange esoteric subjects. Sometimes my wife gets a bit worried about me, you know, and she sees what I've been reading. For example, in Black Dog, the first book in the series, I needed to know what the difference was between a human bite mark and a bite mark by a dog, you know. And I discovered there are people, and I had no idea at the time, that there are people called forensic odontologists who specialise in identifying bite marks, you know. And I found one of those, and he told me everything I needed to know. It's just a question of finding the right person, but it very odd subjects sometimes. I once needed to know what the weight of a blade on a snowplough and how much damage it would do to a human body if it hit you. Which was one that was quite tricky to find out.
Mm-hmm. We do go into strange areas. Another question, please.
We were talking about the criminologists and all that, but there's a great fan of yours and Stephen's books over there, like with Robert Colbeck. I trust as a reader with Colbeck's past training and with Stephen's, with the new people coming in, I trust that all those updates are being done. You know, it doesn't worry me so much about the police procedure. I know that those characters are keeping up.
Well, I should say that mine actually set in the 1850s when they were, frankly, making procedure up as they went along, because the detective department was only founded in 1842. Yes, please.
I get the impression, Robert, as you said, that Brazil was one of the main characters in the book, that you referred to contemporary events quite frequently. I wonder to what extent contemporary events are referred to in your books.
I do put bits of Cambridge in that are happening. Sometimes they're personal comments. They're potentially going to demolish the police station, and I think I'm going to have to put that in there because Gary has already had thoughts about how ugly it currently is, and if they demolish it and build something else, then, you know, I'm sure he'll have some thoughts on that. I think it does add... I think it's choosing the key ones that give some sort of relevance to the story. I don't go overboard on it, but I would put the odd thing in, definitely.
Stephen, Darbish is very much a character in your books.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, and I try to keep absolutely up to date what's happening. I try to make every book contemporary for the time that it's published. And you'll probably realise that when you're writing a book, that means maybe 12 months in the future. Right, so I'm spending some of my time trying to predict what will be happening in 12 months' time, which is not very, very easy to do. And sometimes I get it just right, you know, and something happens in the real world. I think, wow, that's great. That's just worked fine for me. And other times, of course, you know, I get it wrong. But I'm trying to predict what my characters, for example, will be talking about at that particular time. And a little while ago, there was an idea to merge a lot of police forces. You probably remember this in this country. And Derbyshire Constabulary would have been one of the first forces to disappear, to be merged into a huge East Midlands constabulary. So the force I was writing about was would have gone completely, you know. So I looked at the schedule for when the public consultation was, and I knew, I could see that my characters were, that was be the main subject on their minds at that time, was their force going to be disbanded at the time that the next book was being published. And that's absolutely gold for me, because that makes my book totally contemporary when it comes out.
Mike, you don't exactly celebrate Mongolia, but it's the main character. And what strikes me about it is what the problem they have in Australia, the tyranny of distance. Is such a huge area, and so people getting from A to B is an immense problem for the police. How do you keep in touch and up to date?
Pretty much constant research, really. I mean, and visits when I can. It's as Leighton said, I mean, it's very much the sort of central character in the book in lots of ways. And I think for me, it's linking back to the question. I mean, I think there's what I try to do there is to sort of put in the book a whole series of things that are not specific necessarily contemporary events, but the kinds of trends, the kinds of things that are going on in Mongolia at any one time. So, for example, I mean, the first book's very much around things like the exploitation of the mineral rights in Mongolia, which is a massive sort of ongoing problem. They've got an issue. Again, it's a potentially very wealthy country which has enormous amounts of minerals, but of course lots of people are then jostling position in terms of getting hold of those and getting the rights to them and all the rest of it. A bit like Stephen, I think what I often find is that things that I've kind of put in the books as a kind of speculative idea, by the time the book's published, it actually turned into reality in some ways. And so in the last book, there was a fair bit of stuff in there around potential civil unrest and rioting on the streets and so on, which had never happened in Mongolia until sort of middle of last year, when there was a whole series of riots which were to do with sort of perceptions of government corruption and all those kind of things. And it wasn't precisely what was in the book, but it was quite close to the way things were emerging in the book. And I think that's quite gratifying in a way when that happens, because it kind of suggests you've got your fingers sort of on the pulse of the way the country's developing, even if, let's say the precise
Can
details may be different.
Question?
Sure.
Mike, I just asked Edward's permission to ask you a question. We know pretty much how the cops react to your books, but I'm curious as to how the Mongolians might react if your books were to be translated into Mongolia.
Yeah, I mean, they've not been translated into Mongolia yet, but they are on sale in Ulaanbaatar, apparently, because there's some enterprising person who runs a sort of Mongolian adventure holidays outfit, who also has a shop selling Mongolian goods and things in the centre of Ulaanbaatar, who's got the books on sale, which is fascinating. But I had quite a bit of feedback from particularly Mongolians who are living in the West, and particularly living in the UK. And I'm gratified to say, in general, the feedback's always been very, very positive. You know, people that say, we think you've got it pretty close. I think you're always conscious, I'm very conscious, that you're always writing as an outsider in these things, and therefore you perhaps can't quite get behind it in the same way you would do if you were part of the culture yourself. But I think I'm fairly honest about that. But I try to get as right as I can, and the feedback I've had is that, by and large, you do. And I've now got one or two people that I can bounce the books off before they're published and sort of say, is this right? Have I got it right?
Leighton, the question I really want to ask you is how many Christmas cards your wife has to send. But the one I'm going to ask you is, how are your books received in Brazil?
Those books have not been translated into Portuguese. And my wife, who came in a while back and is sitting over there, doesn't want them to be, which was one of the reasons why I asked this question of Mike. Because it's interesting. I don't know. If you look at cinema, there have been three very good Brazilian films made in the last 5 or 6 years. One of them is called, the English language title is Elite Troop. Another one, the English language title is City of God. Another one is Carindiru, which deals with a prison riot in Sao Paulo. All of these films deal with exactly the same kind of issues and deal with them in exactly the same kind of way that my books do. The difference is they've been written and directed by Brazilians. Mm-hmm. And the reason I asked this thing of Mike is the fact that I don't think any country likes to be criticized or will accept easily criticism from someone who is not a native of that country. And the fact that I have children with Brazilian passports, the fact that the language I use at home is Portuguese, the fact that over the last 30 years I've spent much more of my time in Brazil than I have anywhere else, doesn't justify it. They don't like it.
Mm.
question. There are two writers right now who write about Asia, Colin Cotterell with his Cambodia, Vietnam, and Elliot Patterson, who writes about Tibet. Both of those authors incorporate a lot of spiritualism in the resolution of the crime or the cause of crime. In your first book, Liberation Theology, issues were religious issues. Does Mongolia have that background also? Is that also part of the way people think?
It is, to some extent. I mean, certainly in Mongolia, it's been a lot of that has been suppressed for a long time, and there's and therefore the kind of the Buddhist movement is only gradually beginning to sort of reemerge and reassert itself. There is, I mean, it's a whole culture of shamanism. There's a whole culture of spirituality that sits behind that, and I haven't particularly used that yet in any of the books, but it's one of the things that's kind of lurking in my mind, that would give us sort of interesting theme and some interesting ideas, and it nearly emerged in the last book, but then in the end I decided not to use it. But it's, I mean, certainly for me, it's something that kind of I'm seeing as part of the mindset that's driving certainly the lead protagonist, Nogue. I mean, I think it's not probably emerged as clearly as it might do yet in the books, but I think it's something for me that sits there somewhere in him is that sort of spiritual mindset which drives the way he thinks about things and the way he thinks about the country. So I think it is there. It's not there as explicitly yes as it is in someone like Colin Cotterill or Elliot Patterson, but I think it's certainly part of the country and it's certainly part of the mindset. And I think particularly the whole shamanism thing is absolutely fascinating. There's a whole culture there which is very different from anything that we're used to in the West.
Yes, please.
Leighton, you talked about the great disparities of income and wealth in Brazil, particularly off of the opening chapters of your second book. I'd like you to talk a bit about how these disparities work their way down into the daily lives of your cops.
There are a number of popular expressions in Brazil that kind of reflect that a bit. One of them is, rich people don't go to jail. This expression exists. Os ricos não vão para a cadeia. It's a popular expression, and it's generally believed. I can't say a friend of ours, but a man we knew very well, the brother of a good friend of ours, was a lawyer who was specialized in murder, wasn't it, Adina? Irmão da Cristina Carvalho Pinto.
Yeah.
And he had something like 600 jury trials. Now, he's a very expensive lawyer. So in the course of his career, a jury in Brazil is not a 12-man jury or a 14-man jury. It's a group of seven people. And this is drawn from a pool, which is a regular pool of people who most of them have regular contact. You know, they'll do three or four trials a year, same people all the time. So you get to know these people. You know? And I think in 600 trials, he was a very expensive lawyer, he had 8 convictions or something like that. So you see, this sort of thing, there's one legal system for the poor and there's another legal system for the wealthy. And the corruption goes right down from the judges, through the prosecutors, through the police. There's a judge the other day, how much did he steal? $100 million. $100 million. Judge. Doing well. Terrific profession. Yeah. And I've known a couple of judges, and you know that exists. So to find an honest cop, there are different kinds of police corporations in Brazil. So in addition to the federal, you have the state, and then you have the civil police, let's say. And then you sometimes have municipal police. The further down you get, the smaller the area covered by those police, the more poorly they're paid. So some of them, bribes, of course, are very common. They have to find some way to supplement their income. Some of them would take a second job. Most of them take the easy route, principally because if they don't, then they encounter a lot of problems from their colleagues. I mean, you can enter into a given police force with the best will in the world and a desire to be completely honest, and then you find that the people around you are saying, if you don't play ball, why don't you leave? And this happened to a lady we met who really didn't need the money. She wanted to be a law enforcement officer, and a good one, and an honest one. But in the end, she had to give it up because of the pressure from her peers.
So all of these aspects of the rich in Brazil do feel very privileged. And if you are rich in Brazil, believe me, you live better than virtually anyone in Europe. You do. It's a very privileged existence. And this is reflected in the whole criminal system. Did I answer your question, Peter?
Not quite. It was really more a comment than a question, because police corruption we're all familiar with.
Okay.
At the beginning of the second book, there's kind of a, not just a, there's a hierarchy of corruption. There's a higher level of corruption and a lower level of corruption. So it's a better developed system of corruption.
Yeah. Right.
Can we take another question, please? Yes, please. The question, in case you didn't hear it, is if you read police procedures by other writers, do they affect the way that you write? Stephen?
Yes, do they affect the way that you think?
Mm-hmm. By the way, I think. The fact is, if I'm in the middle of writing one of my own novels, I tend not to read other people's novels. That's one of the reasons, I think. You know, I tend to read non-fiction because it's difficult for me to go into somebody else's fictional world and back into my own. And do that, so I tend to avoid it. But it is true that even in a small country like Britain, different police forces do different things in different ways. For example, in Derbyshire they still have scenes of crime officers, old SOCOs, and in other forces they call them entirely different things, forensic investigators or whatever. And it's one of those little details that you can very easily get wrong. And I've known, I mean, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but there are certain writers who do get that wrong, and they're not necessarily British writers, so I'll put it that way.
Alison?
You wouldn't mention her name. No,
I'm not going to mention her, not today.
No, I'm like Stephen. I do tend to steer clear of anything that I think might be an overlap, either in terms of like the theme of the story or being a similar sort of type of book in terms of where it is in the marketplace. But I do think you can quite easily start to get a bit tunnel-like. If you don't read anybody else, you don't pick up new ideas. And sometimes when you do read other people's work, you think, oh, well, I haven't thought about doing, I don't know, whatever, that sort of branching out in that direction, and then it gives you ideas for later on. But while I'm writing, I do tend to steer clear of anything that I think might be too similar. So I read something radically different, really.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree we've had a very good panel here with a wonderfully wide spectrum. I can speak personally of the three writers here because I know their work, and the first thing I'll do when I get home is to order one of Leighton's books, because they sound absolutely terrific. Thank you very much for coming. There will be a signing session afterwards. Shop early for Christmas.